Psalm number 36. This is a psalm which in its comparatively short compass enshrines a strong contrast between the wickedness of the wicked and the blessing of the righteous, as may be found within the Psalter. Note that the title describes David as the servant of the Lord. Only here, as I said during the reading and in the title of the great 18th Psalm, is David called the servant of the Lord. The designation servant of the Lord is midway between that of child of God and soldier of the Lord. The three stages, child, servant, soldier, by which born-again souls advance in involvement with the Lord, is an interesting sequence. And we may regard the third stage of soldier as preparatory to the three stages or classes in the school of spiritual warfare, the military academy, as in the booklet Towards Spiritual Maturity. These three are, as the book says, strategic retreat, that is, running into Christ for shelter in an evil day, unyielding defense, standing one's ground, that is, in face of attack, and of course that conforms to the defensive armor in Ephesians chapter 6, and all-out attack with the offensive sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, wielded by all prayer. Ephesians 6, 18. Here, then, is a sweep of the Christian life from beginning to glory. The psalm has a most remarkable opening. The writer calls the poem an oracle deep in his heart concerning the wickedness of the sinful. He then goes on to say about the wicked that there is no fear of God before their eyes. So it is undoubtedly the wicked that the psalmist has in mind when he speaks of what is deep within his heart. But at least one commentator has suggested that David is also revealing his understanding of the wicked because of the evil in his own heart. Not excusing it, of course, but owning it. Owning that it is there. Now, that's a fascinating thought, isn't it? For you see, it bridges what lies between what a man acknowledges and deplores to be of evil in his heart and what he may be tempted to give way to. You see? And one would hope there was a gap. And one would hope there was a gap in the heart and mind of David, although later he lapsed so seriously, between what he felt in his heart and what he would never dream of doing in response to it. Does that ring a bell with you? Arthur Weiser, the German commentator, links these thoughts with the fall and says that basically our temptation is to listen to another voice and master than that of God. Even the voice of sin instigated by the serpent Satan. Certainly the depth of the evil heart of man, which Jeremiah said, you remember, was deceitful above all things and beyond cure, is the depth of it is that it inclines to cherish, are you listening? A secret sympathy with sin. You see. Which is absolutely fatal to any attempt to drive it out of our lives. If you have a secret sympathy with sin, you'll never be rid of it. Because only genuine, and we have this in the psalm, only genuine hatred of sin will stand as a bulwark against it. We were saying that of Joseph on Wednesday at Bible study. Withstanding the evil blandishments of Potiphar's wife, he, from his moral standpoint, a giant, a moral giant, this young man, who at one point was so vain, he, from his moral standpoint, hated what she wanted him to do, so that there was no question of his succumbing, however long she pestered him. And that example, by the way, in particular, we know, would appeal to David, wouldn't it? And that's exactly what verse 2 is saying. Adam, under the influence of the serpent, took his eyes off his maker and master, and looked in upon himself, and so flattered himself in his own estimation. So much did he flatter himself in his own estimation that he no longer saw sin as sin, and therefore hated it, but rather loved it. Being then on the defensive with his maker, he played hide and seek with him and hid himself in the garden, you remember, which was the essence of deceit. And so his chief occupation thereafter was that of planning and plotting evil even on his bed. As the only thing which now interests him, he now commits himself to a sinful course, largely, although not entirely, unaware of how sinful it is, and gives himself to it with aplomb and enthusiasm. You see, because he's learned to love sin. What about you and me? This takes us immediately from Genesis chapter 3 to Romans chapter 1, where we have, I believe, the best explanation of Genesis chapter 3 in the Bible. You see, we must never forget the deliberateness of Adam and Eve's sin in swerving from the right, the serpent's deceit notwithstanding. You see, that's why God is angry, as Paul tells us in this chapter. That's why God is angry both with Satan and with man. Because as Paul says, what may be known of God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. I say, isn't that an awful indictment of agnostics and atheists? That's why one is perfectly entitled to say that there is not such a being on the face of the earth as an honest atheist or honest agnostic. God says they do know. He says it, and he should know. He is flying in the face of God, and great will be the crash when they meet, either at the judgment seat or before. Paul goes on in this first chapter of Romans, for although they knew God, see what he says, take it in, use this in evangelism, in your office and workshop and desk or class or wherever. Use this. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. Of course they wouldn't. This is what angers the Almighty, you see. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened, although they claimed to be wise, of course. They became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man, and then declining birds and animals and reptiles. You see the steps of decline from men to birds and beasts and snakes. In fact, you see this most evidently in the modern trend of young people, in particular today, to look as ugly as possible, with huge amounts of hair all over their faces and as unkempt as mad hairdressers can make them, with clothes as drab, untidy, and unwholesome looking that you wonder if they smell. In fact, too many people you see on the streets today look more like rag bags than like upright human nature. Look at the fashion shows. Aren't they the funniest thing out? Do you not sometimes feel like standing and facing people when you see them in the street who look like something which has just escaped the dustman, and laughing loudly at the sight of them? Only, perhaps, that's what they want. I always remember my father in the faith telling me that one day, as a young Salvation Army officer, he was walking down the street with an older officer when a sight hove into view. And Oliver stared at her until his older companion gave him a dig and said, "Don't look, Oliver, don't look, that's what she wants." Yeah. But the sight, you see, is one thing. What it betokens deep down, as David is saying, is much more serious. It is the sickness which follows taking our eyes off our Maker and turning them inwards on ourselves, so that from now on, I am my own God, said Adam and Eve, I am my own God. And a pretty mess I'm making at being my own God too, when you think of the Tower of Babel. Now David saw all this, although, mind you, it didn't prevent him in the end from succumbing to the grossest temptation. And as an older man, alas, too, from which we conclude that sin doesn't die out with age. No. There are as many aged wicked as there are youthful wicked. It's just that the young have more energy. But perhaps older people are able, from their experience and their practice, to hatch more evil and cunning plots. Well, let's leave all that for a change and look at the second part of David's poem. What a change! This is another world. It reminds us of the difference we experience or may experience between, say, seeing on television almost at any time a program full of crime and violence, bad language, and the very atmosphere of evil about it, and then hurriedly switching off, transporting ourselves to the heart of a Christian fellowship where all is warmth and light and grace and goodness. And you say, oh, why must there be that world when there's this one? Neither the twain shall meet. Well, you see, if one saw the other, would it not look like hell to heaven? Or heaven to hell? Hell's angels would think our heaven their hell, with no strife, noise, carousing, coarse laughter, and bawdy jokes. It's what they're used to. But then, you see, David knew all about evil. He's been describing it. And it is he who turns as if in unutterable loathing to this other scene, which is literally heavenly. Your love, O Lord, he says, reaches the heavens. But then, that's an interesting beginning, isn't it? Why reaching the heavens? We thought heaven was in the skies, reaching down to earth. Of course, it has to come down before it can reach up, and that's the incarnation. Love came down at Christmas because he came down to lift us up to the skies. And the skies are spacious, as this psalm is. Not like dark caverns in which evil is plotted. Sometimes you see scenes of wickedness on the screen almost in the dark, so that as far as you can discern, something sinister is going on and is being perpetrated in some dungeon, probably, with muffled curses and violent movements, guns suddenly sticking out at you from everywhere. And in disgust, you switch to a nature program with sunshine streaming down from a smiling sky, birds singing, rolling hills, water flowing, transporting music, and such an air of sweetness and light as simply entrances your soul. This is it. This is it here. Your love reaches the heavens. Your faithfulness the skies. Your rightness is like mighty mountains, and your justice is like a great gorge with a beautiful valley nestling at the foot of it. Ah, but wait, it's living creatures the Lord is most interested in. He preserves man and beast. How priceless is your love, priceless, priceless. Isn't that a wonderful word here? The last chapter of Proverbs, you remember, begins so memorably. I love to read it in memoriam of some dear soul who has passed into heavenly glory. Who can find a virtuous woman? Her virtue is priceless, far above the price of rubies, because it comes from priceless love. That's why it's priceless. Then there come those choice words, both high and low. And he cares for both, whether the high, as some people think, are angels or not. Both high and low find refuge in the shade of your wings. Isn't that beautiful? Ah, but come down to earth. The Lord comes down to dwell with his saints in an earthly house. Meantime, he has given us this gleaming new building in which to meet with him. And he says, you give them drink from the river of your delights. Is this Eden? Is this the new Eden from Revelation? Or is it Ezekiel's river, you remember, streaming forth from the city and temple of God to water the whole land until fish are swimming in the Dead Sea and its healing and refreshing streams pour themselves out into the Red Sea and eventually into the Mediterranean or the Arabian Sea? You know the picture. For he goes on, for with you is the fountain of life. Ah, in your light we see light. Now, how deep is that statement? For with you is the fountain of life. In your light we see light. You remember that in the beginning of the creation, there was light before there were lights. And there will be light after these lights, glorious as are the sun and the moon and the stars. There will be light after these lights. Now affording us light and warmth and energy and power, are no more. John in his revelation says, you remember, the holy city of God does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp, I say. The Lamb is its lamp. Do you notice that change of one letter gives us lamp from Lamb? Isn't that wonderful? And the nations shall walk by its light, and there will be no, oh dear, wasn't it dark at 4:30? Today, there will be no night there. Why? You see, we're in heaven. And it is that heaven streaming down from above which is to lift us up to the skies, away, away from all the hell holes of this present evil world. But of course, this is the world in which we must live. We'd better see, you know, at least sometimes, on our screens or wherever we go, what the real evil world is like. In fact, it is very wrong to shield children altogether from ugliness and evil. They can take it better than grown-ups, although one should be careful not to shock them and have some sensitivity as to how sensitive each individual child is. But don't shield them too far. Many, many children who have been too shielded have gone right into the world, and some of them never come out. No. Yes, we need to know at least something of what the real evil world is like. How can we pray for it otherwise, in order to plunge into it when we have to, or are called to rescue souls from perdition and snatch them from everlasting burning, as Jude says, you remember? So, David says, we need your help, Lord. Your love, this wonderful love, which carries us heavenwards, and one day it will take those who know you. Ah! Oh, the shocking universalism of so many who speak about religion as if everybody was going to heaven. What an empty hell they think there must be and will be. What a mistake. What a mistake. No. Yes. This wonderful love carrying us heavenwards, which one day will take those you know right up there forever and ever. But we need to know him first. I said that to a lad last Sunday evening. Don't you know the Lord? I couldn't live without him, son. And he looked at me. Continue your love to those who know you. And Lord, cause many more in these days to come to know you, including this dear lad. And continue your righteousness. That is, your rightness to the upright in heart. That is, those who have been straightened out by you and sorted out. So that no foot of the proud comes against me, he says. Ah, no foot of the proud or hand drive me away. Talking about feet, that man, John McIntosh, who writes such lurid stuff in the press and journal, had a horrible sentence at the beginning of his article the other day, replete, of course, with plenty blasphemy, about a brogue kicking a person in the groin. I thought, you violent creature, what a polluted mind you must have to pour out such beastliness for our delectation on a sunny morning. Preserve us from them, Lord. There is more than enough violence in the world already without having the media adding to it. Adding to it, they often encourage it. Did you hear Alistair Cook speaking about that this morning? The media has ruined America. And is fast ruining this country. And they do nothing about it. These leaders of ours. These suave leaders of ours. For all I said about John Reith this morning, they need him. But these writers apparently know nothing but such lawlessness. Sometimes you wonder what's in the minds of those who write the plays and television. Minds like sinks, putrid, cesspools. Have they ever read the Bible? Do they know anything about purity and humility? I don't believe they do. That's their world. And if they landed in the world David is talking about here, with its light and its glory and its warmth of love, they would think they had landed in some kind of hell. Oh yes, they would. I've seen people who came in here from the street by chance, perhaps just to have a look and listen to us, and after a little while turning and walking out as if they'd been bitten. It was a kind of hell to them. They couldn't stand it any longer. I've seen them fidgeting and at last up as if they I can't stand this any longer. Remember that the rich man in Jesus' parable didn't ask Lazarus to take him out of his world, just to cool his tongue of its torment. Our heaven is their hell. That's why they would rather die than enter a house of God. They'd rather repair to a ministry of sin. Let them, Lord, and protect us from them, Lord, with their kicking feet and brutal hands. So David ends his poem with their downfall. I was a little sorry about that, but we're not going to end this evening with their downfall, David. No, we're not. Because you have given us something better to think about in the intermediate part of your poem. And that's what we're going to think about. And that's what we've been singing about this evening. Having shown us the evil world and its down drag, with its wealth of deception, whereby sinners are deprived of the slightest notion as to how they stand before their Maker, so that they strut the stage of life in their horrid disguise as lords and masters of their fate, whereas all the time they are but puny pawns in Satan's sleazy game of chess, in which it is his damnable pleasure to checkmate them, humiliate them, and win them over from Jesus if he can, merely to spite the Lord of glory, because he has triumphantly unseated Satan. Then the evil fellow lands his quarries in hell with him. Where even the most complete and conspiratorial earthly friendship amongst evil men, the most evil friendship is bound to end, because no two denizens of that fiery place will ever agree as they claw at the blazing inferno and gnaw their tongues for relief and yet continue, as John tells us in the Revelation, to curse God. Over against that, all that, David, you have shown us love, heavenly love, coming down from above to draw us up to that heaven to which we aspire when we have spent, please God, our days down here spreading the fragrance of heaven's perfume far around a stinking world of dung and filth and degradation. From all thought of these horrid things, David, you swiftly transport us to those realms of light and love which speed us through the clouds of cynicism and doubt which surround us to emerge into that illimitable world of blazing sunshine which never sets, but which, as it revolves, gives us nightly respite from its radiant glory. Our mortal bodies can't yet stand the strain of unalloyed brightness of heaven. And so it revolves and gives us night in order to rest our weary mortal frames for a little, to be wakened again in the morning to life. Indeed, in the light and love of everlasting glory. Are you living? Are you living in this heavenly world? Will you be living in it tomorrow morning? How wonderful to walk with God and companion with Jesus, and have him help us in the hardest and sorest things we have to do tomorrow or the next day. Oh, the friendship of Jesus. When I looked into the face of that laddie sitting down there beside me last Sunday night, I said, "Oh, son, don't you know him?" Oh. Wonderful. But let's sing.